Hey, y'all. This is Dr. Jeremy Sharp, and this is the Testing Psychologist Podcast, episode number 82. Today, we have Dr. Ross Green on the podcast. This is an interview that I've been looking forward to for a long time. I've used Dr. Green's approach, collaborative and proactive solutions, professionally and personally with my own kids quite a bit. He is an excellent interviewee. He has a lot to say, and he is passionate about what he is doing. If you're not familiar with Dr. Green, he has a lengthy bio to get acquainted with. He is the founding director of Lives in the Balance, a nonprofit aimed at advancing, you know, the mission of helping kids with challenging behaviors and educating the public, educating teachers, and really helping those kids who tend to slip through the cracks in the schools and elsewhere. He served on the faculty at Harvard Medical School for over 20 years. He's now an associate professor at Virginia Tech and an adjunct professor at the University of Technology, Sydney in Australia. Dr. Green also recently added executive producer, I believe, to his resume. He has a documentary that's currently screening across the country called The Kids We Lose, and we talk a bit about that in addition to many other things during our interview today. So without further ado, I give you Dr. Ross Green. Hello. Welcome back, everyone, to the Testing Psychologist Podcast. This is Dr. Jeremy Sharp. And today I have with me Dr. Ross Green. Y'all may have heard of Dr. Green. I hope you have heard of Dr. Green and his work. It's, you know, kind of a new take or different take on behavior management for kids. We'll get into it in great detail, but he's someone that I've followed for years. And one of those guests, you know, when I started the podcast, I thought, oh, that would be incredible if I could get Ross Green on the podcast. And so here we are. So I'm very grateful for that. Ross, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on. You got me.
It's happening. It is happening. Yeah. Yeah. It's great. I think I mentioned in my, you know, the email that I sent you to reach out initially that it's something, you know, I've been tapped into your model for our own kid and as a clinician, of course. So the personal and professional side, it just has been really important in my life. So I'm really excited to be talking to you today. I appreciate
it. Glad to be talking to you.
Cool. Well, so usually we kind of ease into it just by getting an idea of who you are, what you do day to day, how you got where you are. So I'll just kind of leave that door open and let you take it where you might. Does that sound okay?
Absolutely. Well, who am I? Child psychologist, grew up in Miami, Florida, now live in Portland, Maine, when I'm actually in Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm. Where am I? That's a very good question in terms of how did I get here? You know, professionally, I went to grad school and gravitated to kids with ADHD. Mm. And if you're working with kids with ADHD, you're going to be working with kids with oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder.
Yeah.
And that's who I really gravitated to because I felt like they were not a very well understood population. And that's been validated by all the work I've been doing over the last 30 some odd years. This is a poorly understood and poorly treated population. It's not my way to sort of sit and watch things not go well. So I had to buck up against my own training a little bit because I was trained as a reward and punishment guy. And I was finding that that really wasn't what the vast majority of these kids seemed to need. Mm-hmm. Helped out by the research that's accumulated over the last 40 to 50 years, what became quite clear is that challenging behavior is just the signal, just the fever, just the way the kid is communicating that he or she is stuck. But more technically, and the wording here is crucial, having difficulty meeting certain expectations.
Yes.
And that it wasn't a lack of motivation that was making it difficult for them to meet those expectations. It was lagging skills. And that is just a completely different set of lenses. And it leads us in a completely different direction in terms of intervention. Mm-hmm. So I started trying some new ideas on for size, especially related to prioritizing all of the expectations the kid was having difficulty meeting. Instead of using incentives to try to modify their behavior, I began trying to solve the problems that were causing that behavior. Over time, the middle word of the model, collaborative and proactive solutions, became incredibly important because so much of what we do to these kids occurs in the heat of the moment. It's reactive.
Right.
You don't have to use your crisis management strategies if you are in crisis prevention mode. And the problem solving is a whole lot better if it's collaborative instead of unilateral. And so those were pretty much the key themes that have driven the work and everything I've been doing for the last 30 years or so. And so I'm not exactly sure where I'm at, except Portland, Maine. That's how I got here.
Sounds good. What was that like to, like you said, buck against your training? Was that happening as a grad student or as a early career psych or what? That sounds hard.
Early career. Well, even as a grad student, I was questioning whether rewarding and punishing and contingency contracting and behavior was really all there was to it, and mm-hmm. whether those should be our only focal points. So that was happening in grad school. I started trying some new things on for size shortly after grad school. And, you know, truth is, it was a little scary because I was not only bucking up against my training, but I was bucking up against some pretty influential figures who I worried might simply blast me for thinking that there might be more to helping kids than rewarding and punishing. The good news is at no point have I felt blasted. Because the truth is, well, collaborative and proactive solutions flows from, theoretically at least, similar underpinnings. It's still social learning theory that's a lot of the underpinnings of CPS. Mm-hmm. And that's the underpinning of rewarding and punishing as well. So long as I have been helping people understand that, and so long as I have been emphasizing that B.F. Skinner talked every bit as much about conditions as I do, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't call them conditions, I call them unmet expectations or unsolved problems. That seems to make a whole lot of folks feel a whole lot better.
I bet. That's a good rephrase. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It's not that far away, you know.
Well, you know, I was on a call with my mentor, Tom Ollendick, who's largely a parent management training guy. Okay. And, you know, we were on the phone the other night because we were reviewing some data that we collected in Australia on comparing CPS to parent management training. Uh-huh. And he was saying that he's sometimes amazed that people don't see the difference between CPS and PMT. From both of our perspectives, they are very different ways of thinking and doing things, even if they emanate from similar theoretical foundations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, yeah. The way that they manifest and come about and get put into action, it seems like, I mean, are vastly different, right?
Seems like it to me.
Seems like it. That's my perception. Well, I would love to talk about that data. That's interesting right off the bat. Before we totally jump into all of that, can you just talk a little bit about what your life looks like now? I mean, are you doing any private practice at all, or is it a lot of just speaking and writing and whatnot?
Speaking, writing, running a nonprofit, which probably takes up more of my time than anything else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nice.
Is that the Lives in the Balance?
Lives in the Balance, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't draw any income from Lives in the Balance. So basically the speaking and the royalties from the writing permit me to run a nonprofit, and a nonprofit that doesn't have to pay me any money, so that there's a lot of things we can do because I'm not taking any money from the organization. Sure. I do still see some kids. It's had to, I've had to drop it off a fair amount, mostly because my schedule is so funky that there are the kids who I like working with the most are the very severe ones, but they need a lot of me. Mm-hmm. Their families need a lot of me, and their schools need a lot of me. And with my traveling, there's not always a lot of me to give. And so I don't want to feel like I am doing them a disservice by taking them on and then not being able to provide them with the level of care that they need. And so still working with a meaningful number of kids, just nowhere nearly as many as I used to. Still love it. And it still keeps me sharp. And it still, quite frankly, keeps me in touch with just how hard it is out there.
Right.
For everybody.
Right. Yeah. I was just going to say, I mean, I think it's nice to have both sides. I interview a lot of folks who are both academics and clinicians, and it's nice to be able to marry the two and not get too far away from either one.
I agree.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's, in case, I'm sure there's somebody out there who doesn't know what we're talking about when you say CPS and lives in the balance and collaborative and this and that. And so can we zoom way out just for a minute and talk to me about what this model is, what it's about, where it came from, what do we use it for? Yeah.
Got it. Well, you can use it for just about any problem that needs to be solved and just about any setting in which the problem needs to be solved. So in my personal experience, professional experience, this has been done with thousands of families, hundreds of schools, dozens of inpatient units and inpatient psychiatry units and residential facilities, one system of juvenile detention, one adult inpatient psychiatry unit,
wow,
a few adult prisons. And you know, one thing I would say is that I don't really see much difference among the people who this is applied to. You know, mm-hmm, if I'm doing this with a psychotic adult and I'm doing this with a three-year-old kid, believe it or not, I'm not seeing a whole lot of differences between them as it relates to identifying the skills that they're lacking, which is one of the things the CPS model has us doing, and solving the problems that are causing the behaviors that so many other people are focused on. So the big themes of the model are, number one, that you're focused on problems, not behaviors. Once again, the behaviors are just the signal. The behaviors just communicate to us that there's an expectation that a kid is having difficulty meeting, or an adult. We've got to figure out what those are. That's crucial. And so this model would not have us completing behavior checklists. It really wouldn't emphasize doing behavior observations. It would have us sitting down with caregivers and identifying a kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems using an instrument that I developed called the Assessment of Lagging Skills and Unsolved Problems, available for free, just like everything else on the Lives in the Balance website.
Yeah.
Once we identify those problems, we're going to be solving them with the kid. Well, first we have to prioritize them, because a lot of the kids who are getting in trouble the most, mm-hmm, believe it or not, are going to have 30, 40, 50 different unsolved problems if we're identifying them the right way. And by the way, they do tend to accumulate over time.
Uh-huh.
The reason they accumulate over time is because people tend not to be focused on solving those problems. They tend to be focused on modifying the behaviors that are the byproduct of those problems. And modifying behavior solves no problems. I think that's a very important theme. You're solving nothing by modifying a kid's behavior. You may be making a dent in the behavior, but you certainly aren't solving the problem that's causing that behavior. And that's huge.
That is huge.
So the other big themes are that the problem solving is collaborative, not unilateral,
mm-hmm,
and proactive, not reactive. So one of the big goals of this model is to get caregivers and kids out of the heat of the moment, where there is nothing incredible to do except what the crisis management programs tell us to do: defuse, de-escalate, keep everybody safe. Those problems are best solved proactively. And quite frankly, the best use of our crisis management strategies is to never have to use them. But you're going to have to use them if you're not being proactive. So those are the big themes. And then the rest of it is just the technicalities of how we go about solving a problem collaboratively and proactively, because there are many ways to do it incorrectly. And so a lot of what I've been doing for the last 10 years is trying to build in protections, guidance, guidelines, strategies for making sure people stay on track in their efforts to solve problems collaboratively and proactively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned parent management training. You know, a lot of us, I think, were brought up in that model in grad school and you know, have recommended it to varying degrees over the years. And so this is, again, just to be super clear and super basic, it's like an alternative to parent management training. It's a different way to work with kids who are exhibiting disruptive behavior. Is that fair?
Would you use that fair word? To tell you the truth, I don't actually distinguish. I don't slice the pie by what kind of behavior a kid is exhibiting.
Hmm.
These days, I've been saying that I think that we have become too diagnostically oriented.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's one way to slice the pie. Here's how I slice the pie. As it relates to the behaviors kids and other human beings exhibit to communicate to us that they're having difficulty meeting certain expectations, we all fall into one of two categories. You're either lucky or you're unlucky. So lucky ways of communicating that are things like whining, pouting, sulking, withdrawing, crying. Unlucky ways are screaming, swearing, hitting, spitting, biting, throwing, destroying, running, and worse. What the field of developmental psychopathology tells us is that that is not the way to slice the pie. So if you're asking me, who would I do this with? Number one, what type of kid is having difficulty meeting expectations? The answer is all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Would I reserve this only for kids who are communicating that they're having difficulty meeting expectations in ways that are unlucky? I can't imagine why I would. And so I don't really make that distinction. That said, I would say that most clinicians and most educators and staff in restrictive therapeutic facilities are struggling more with unlucky kids than they are with lucky kids. The reason I refer to the unlucky ones as unlucky is because these are the kids who we are popping into timeout, depriving of recess, holding them after school, giving them millions of detentions a year in American public schools, millions of in and out of school detentions, suspensions mm-hmm. every year, 5.4 million of those a year, just suspensions in American public schools. We expel them at the rate of about over 100,000 a year. We do hundreds of thousands of restraints and seclusions a year. We paddle them in American public schools, still in 19 different states, over 100,000 times every school year.
Oh my gosh. I did not know that.
Don't know that. That's unlucky. And sure. It's not only unlucky in terms of your behavior, because we are treating you as if you are somehow different from kids who are communicating that they're having difficulty meeting expectations in ways that are lucky. But these are things that are very counterproductive. They don't help. And what they mostly serve the purpose of doing is pushing this kid away from people who could help him if they had the right lenses on and if they had strategies beyond those which were oriented toward rewarding and punishing.
Yeah, yeah. Those are some powerful numbers. The paddling especially is completely, that blows my mind that in public school in the United States, there's still paddling happening.
That's because you haven't yet seen the movie, The Kids We Lose.
That's right. That's right. Yes. We got to talk about them. So
at one point, not to be now.
Okay. We'll bookmark that. Yeah. That's probably, yeah, that's one of the newer developments for you. You can add filmmaker to your resume.
I can add executive producer. I don't know if I count as filmmaker technically, but I count as developer and executive producer at this point.
That's fantastic. So let me ask, is lucky versus unlucky hereditary, predetermined? How does that happen?
I was taught in grad school that everything's 100% nature and 100% nurture.
Okay.
So I think that there are genetic predispositions. I'm a big believer in the diathesis stress model. I'm a big believer on all those models that tell us that you may be at a predisposition to have difficulty or to develop a certain condition if we're talking about disorders. But it still takes a environmental stressor to bring that out in you. which explains, quite frankly, why so many people who have a genetic predisposition towards something don't develop it. And some who have a genetic predisposition do. Everything's 100% nature and 100% nurture. Believe it or not, although I have an intellectual curiosity about risk factors and about how a particular kid came to be this way, as it relates to individual kids, I spend almost zero time trying to explain how this kid got to be this way.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, the reason is often I can't do anything about how he came to be this way. But what I can do something about are the lagging skills and unsolved problems that are how he is, that are the way he is, right? And so one of my pet peeves is that I think we mental health professionals and others too spend way too much time trying to nail down with precision, and you can't nail this down with precision anyways, how this kid got to be this way. I would much rather talk about lagging skills so that we have the right lenses on, unsolved problems so we know what we're working on. Because if we think that this was due to exposure to alcohol in utero, and the kid is now 12, and if that's all we know, and if that's all we're focused on, we're all sunk, because that was 12 years ago.
Yeah, I've been trying to think how to talk through that with you, because we, you know, it's called the Testing Psychologist Podcast. You know, a lot of us are assessment heavy clinicians, and it seems like the closest that you get to that, and, you know, correct me, I know you will, but is like something talking about like executive functioning, you know.
Now we're in the ballpark.
Okay.
I'm in the ballpark. Talking about how he came by his executive functioning deficits.
Yeah.
That to me seems, well, two things. It's imprecise. It's something we often can't do anything about. So at a very practical level, how he came to be this way is something I don't spend a lot of time on. I'm entertained by it. I find it intellectually interesting. But as it relates to the practicalities of actually helping this kid and his caregivers, generally speaking, not something we can do much about. But executive functioning, language processing, communication skills, emotion regulation skills, cognitive flexibility skills, social skills, now you're talking my language. What I do say about those is that they are very broad categories, and that while they put us in Fenway Park, they don't tell us what section we're sitting in or what seat we're in yet, but at least we're in the ballpark of lagging skills.
Yeah.
But as you well know, as well as I'm assuming all your listeners, executive skills doesn't tell us much.
Sure.
Better than ADHD, but I'd much rather talk about difficulty shifting set. I'd rather talk about difficulties with working memory. So I'd much rather get much more specific. If all I do, and this is practical again, is tell parents that their kid is lacking executive skills, while I have moved them off a diagnosis that tells us about the behaviors the kid is exhibiting because he's lacking those executive skills, I haven't helped them understand their kid very well, because executive skills is too broad. But if I let them know that their kid is having difficulty shifting from one mindset to another, suddenly, this kid has come alive before their very eyes, and many of the challenging episodes that they have been dealing with are now explainable. I've always told, when I had trainees, I always told them that the number one role for us clinicians is to help parents understand what they're dealing with, to help teachers understand what they're dealing with. And that's where a testing psychologist is going to be right up my alley. Because what's usually walking in the door is, tell me what to do.
Yeah.
But my pat line is, can't tell you what to do till I know what you got. So a big part of the most important part of dealing with people early on is to let them know what they got. And what they got, I'm defining in terms of lagging skills and unsolved problems. Then I can tell them what to do. They also want to know how come what I'm doing that's working for my other kids isn't working for this one. If I don't help them understand what they got, my explanation for that second question isn't going to make any sense to them.
Sure. So where do you, see the role of assessment in this whole process? Is there, I mean, is neuropsych assessment helpful, or behavior checklists, or your own checklist?
Checklist guy, because for me, behavior checklists are signal checklists, right? Mm. All a behavior checklist tells me is what signals the kid is emitting, but the behavior checklist doesn't tell me what lagging skills and unsolved problems are causing the kid to emit those signals.
Hmm.
So I'm not a big behavior checklist guy these days. I think neuropsychology has been one of the biggest influences in informing this model.
Oh, how so?
Well, this is a model about lagging skills. The primary explanation for challenging behavior in this model is that it's lagging skills. Where do those lagging skills come from? Neuropsychology. What's listed on the left-hand side of the assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems? Lagging skills. Those are the lenses we want people viewing a kid through. At a practical level, I view the assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems as an assessment tool.
Sure.
And I find that it is sufficient a meaningful percentage of the time. It's when it's insufficient that I'm referring kids for neuropsych testing. And I have my favorite neuropsychologists in this area who I think just explain kids masterfully. And when I was teaching assessment at Virginia Tech, when I was on the faculty there, I was telling people, you know what? Anybody can give a whisk. Anybody can do a Woodcock Johnson. Anybody can do a Ray Ostrich. But so anybody can do that. The eyes of the evaluator, what they're seeing while the testing is going on. To me, that's what defines whether somebody's really good at their craft or just doing testing.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that art versus science, right? I think a lot of people would agree with that. Yeah. And the theme that
I love my local neuropsychologists. I don't refer to them quite as often as I used to because of the assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems.
Mm-hmm.
But every lagging skill on that instrument came from neuropsychology.
Gotcha. Can you describe that instrument a little bit?
Pretty simple. Two sides. Left-hand side is a list of 23 lagging skills.
Mm-hmm.
And those lagging skills come from the executive literature and the language processing and communication skills literature and the emotion regulation literature and the cognitive flexibility literature and the social skills literature. So that's where those skills come from. I didn't make any of them up. I borrowed heavily.
Mm-hmm.
On the right-hand side is where we are writing in expectations the kid is having difficulty meeting.
Okay.
Those are the two in this model. Those are the two most crucial pieces of information. You know, what I always say to trainees is I used to sit in meetings where we talked about everything, especially like on inpatient units. We talk about everything in the kitchen sink, and it's overwhelming, you know, just the number of things you could talk about with a kid. When we do that to caregivers, they don't know what to focus on. They don't know where to start. They don't know what's important. Lagging skills and unsolved problems bring this to a very concrete, basic level of analysis. The other nice thing is, you know, another big model that CPS draws from is transactional mm-hmm. models of development, which basically say to us, it's the fit or match between the characteristics of an individual and the characteristics of the environment that determine outcome. In the CPS model, the characteristics that we are primarily focused on in the individual are lagging skills.
Okay.
What we're primarily focused on with the environment are the expectations the environment is placing on that kid.
Mm-hmm.
If the kid is behaviorally challenging, he's having difficulty meeting a whole bunch of them.
Sure, sure. Can you give an example or two of a lagging skill and a unsolved problem? Yeah.
Let's say we check off the first lagging skill, which is difficulty handling transitions, shifting from one mindset or task to another.
Mm-hmm.
We check it off. This is in my office. This is with parents in a school. This is with teachers gathered around a table in a restrictive therapeutic facility. It's with staff gathered around a table.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have us a meeting. We're going to have us a discussion. We're not going to have people complete the checklist independently because that's not conducive to the discussion. And as I always tell people, you want to get everybody on the same page, a checklist isn't going to do it. A discussion will. You want to get everybody talking the same language, checklist isn't going to do it. A discussion will. If you want to persuade the unpersuaded, a checklist isn't going to do it. A discussion will. So the goal here is to have a discussion, a 50 to 55 minute discussion. First, lagging skill, difficulty handling transitions, shifting from one mindset or task to another. If the caregivers generally agree, or if enough of them feel that that lagging skill applies to this kid, we check it off. We then ask the following question. Can you give me some examples of expectations Tommy is having difficulty meeting that spring to mind when you consider that lagging skill? When you think of him having difficulty handling transitions, shifting from one mindset or task to another. All right. And so let's say one of the caregivers says, well, he has a devil of a time shifting from choice time, this would be in a school, to math. Yeah. That unsolved problem would be worded as difficulty moving from choice time to math.
Okay.
That's an unsolved problem. Okay. Now we're going to ask for more. Any other expectations the kid is having difficulty meeting? When you think of him having difficulty shifting from one mindset or task to another. Well, he's having a hard time coming in from recess back into the classroom. Back into the classroom for what? English. Difficulty coming back into the classroom from recess into English is the wording of our unsolved problem. Now, here's the key. There's certain guidelines for the wording of unsolved problems. It's probably not worth our time to go through, but people can find them on the ALSIP guide on the Lives in a Balance website. But it's the wording of the unsolved problem, as we write it in on the ALSIP, that is going to translate into the wording that we use when we introduce the unsolved problem to the kid when it comes time to solve that problem together. Yes. Here's what it would sound like. I've noticed you've been having difficulty coming back into the classroom for English after recess. What's up? And the conversation is now rolling. That's the beginning of what we call the empathy step of Plan B, which is where we are gathering information from the kid so as to understand what's making it hard for the kid to meet that expectation. And just as long as we're on the topic, the second step is the define adult concern step, which is where the adults are entering their concerns into consideration. What's important about the kid meeting that unmet expectation? And then in the invitation, kid and caregiver are collaborating on a solution, one that addresses the concerns of both parties, concerns that we identified in those first two steps of Plan B.
Cool. So let's, can we just take that example and sort of walk through each of those three just to make it real?
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's go with, so let's say what the kid says in the empathy step is that he's, actually, let me use the other example.
If that's okay. Oh, yeah.
He's having difficulty moving from choice time to math. This is the true one. I'm having trouble. The other one's very common, but I'm having trouble coming up with a kid who I can remember what it would have been recently. So let's use the other one because I often use it as an example.
Yeah.
Let's say the kid, so we say what's up and the kid says, well, I'm playing a game during choice time and the game's not done. Now we've got to start drilling using strategies that are on the drilling cheat sheet on the Lives in a Balance website. Reflective listening being the most important of those strategies. You're not done. I'm not sure I understand what you mean. What do you mean you're not done? Well, I'm playing chess and the chess game isn't done when I have to go to math. Got it. So the chess game isn't done when you have to go to math. Yes? Yes. Help me understand what's hard about that. Well, I don't know who won. Ah, so you want to know who won. Yes. What's keeping you from knowing who won? Well, I could finish the chess game the next day, but it's always getting wrecked between one day and the next, and then I never know who won. Ah, so the chess game is getting wrecked, and so you never find out who won. Any other concerns we should know about as it relates to the difficult, and I'm going very fast here, but any other concerns we should know about as it relates to your difficulty moving from choice time to math? Nope. So if we helped you figure out who won, is there anything else that would be making that difficult for you? No. Got it. My concern is that if you are late for math, you miss a lot of the material, and that makes it harder for you to know what's going on when you do get to math. And it's really important for you to know what's going on when you get to math. Invitation. I wonder if there's a way. The invitation always begins with the words, I wonder if there's a way. And generically, it's, I wonder if there's a way for us to do something about ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, and also do something about ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And now we're giving the kid the first crack in the at the solution. So now we're going to plug in the concerns of both parties. I wonder if there's a way for us to make sure we know who won, and also make sure that you don't miss the material at the beginning of math. Do you have any ideas? Well, this was a true one. We could put the chess game up high on a shelf so it doesn't get wrecked from one day to the next.
Okay.
If that solution works, that problem is solved. If that problem is solved, it won't set in motion challenging behavior. And so not only are you solving a problem, you are also reducing the challenging behavior. And once again, as the data tell us, at least as well as you would be if you were using reward and punishments to modify that behavior. And you are simultaneously teaching the kid many of the skills that he or she is lacking just by solving problems collaboratively and proactively.
Yeah, yeah.
What I call the 3-for-1 sale.
I like it. I like it. So can you say more about that teaching the kid skills that he is lacking in the first place? How are they developing those skills through that process?
Just by engaging in those three steps. So, and by the way, I don't always say this too loudly, but it's not just the kid who's learning skills.
Sure.
Whoever's doing plan B with the kid is learning skills too. So in the empathy step, and we've got a graphic somewhere on the Lives in the Balance website showing this. I think it's in the paperwork section. In the empathy step, let's think about what skills the kid is learning and practicing. Figuring out what one's concerns are. Figuring out how to articulate those concerns in a way that other people can hear. Others as well. What skills are caregivers learning in the empathy step? Listening, taking another person's perspective, among others. What skills is the kid learning in the Define Adult Concerns step? Same skills the caregivers are learning in the empathy step. What skills are the caregivers learning in the Define Adult Concerns step? The same skills the kid was learning in the empathy step. And what skills are both parties learning in the invitation? Generating alternative solutions. Coming up with solutions that don't just work for you, but that work for somebody else. Resolving disagreement without conflict. Those are collaboration, problem solving. Those are among life's absolute most crucial skills.
Sure.
They're all getting learned and they're all getting practiced when we're doing plan B.
Yeah. The thing that jumps out to me when you describe all of this is that it's, and this was kind of a revelation. It's like, we are treating our kids like people, like actual people, instead of just telling them what to do. And assuming that they don't have any feelings or agency in the process.
One of the words people frequently use about this model is that it's respectful.
Yeah, sure.
That's but I would say it's not just respectful to the kid, it's respectful to anybody who's participating.
Yeah.
But it's also respectful to classmates and siblings because it's if we're not solving these problems with the sibling or with the classmate who's making their life miserable and disrupting the learning process at school, it's also respectful to their teachers, because if they're continuously having to devote massive amounts of time and energy to a disruptive student, mm-hmm. I'm not sure we're doing anybody any favors. So I think the respectful part cuts across many different constituencies. You know, I work with schools all the time on the kids who are disrupting the process of learning in the classroom, who are taking up massive amounts of time, who are getting restraint and seclusion. And the truth is, schools don't want to be doing that stuff. This I know. But often when they find themselves stuck in the heat of the moment, which they don't want to be in the first place, of course, they find that they're so far into it that they got no option. Well, there's lots of options, but none of the good ones are in the heat of the moment. All of them are proactive. Right. But I like to think of it's being respectful all the way around.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm right with you on that. I know that you've alluded to some of the research over the course of our talk, and I would love to dive into that a little bit, if you're willing. And I'm curious, what the research has looked like, both for individuals kind of in a private practice setting, but also schools. Let me back up. So what I hear a lot from both parents and teachers is,
I know what's coming.
Wait, take a guess. Let's see.
I think you're about to talk about time.
That's exactly. I don't have time to have these lengthy discussions every time there's a problem. Yeah. I don't have time to talk to my kid for 30 minutes to get him to eat, to get his shoes on. Yeah.
Right. Well, a few thoughts there. first of all, think of how much time you're taking now. And think about the amount of time that's accumulated with you continuing to struggle. Often, you know, some of these unsolved problems that I come across are 10 years old.
Yeah.
Now let's think about how much time it's going to, but let's not say it's 10 years old. Let's say it's 6 months old, right? Now let's think of the cumulative amount of time we've spent dealing with that problem with it still unsolved. A half an hour is nothing. So this model is actually going to save time. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of logistically, how are we going to make the time so that we start saving the time? But I'll say this, any school or parent that's telling me they don't have time to solve problems with their kids is spending mammoth amounts of time on challenging behavior. That is a given, right?
Absolutely.
So time does tend to be the issue early on as people are first learning about the model, but that's because us parents are really busy. And it takes two incomes to create the lifestyle that one used to. And we are busily shuttling our kids from one enriching activity to another. And all I can say is, I'd rather have a kid know how to solve problems than know how to play the violin. As it relates to the real world, you know, if he becomes a concert violinist, then those violin lessons are going to serve him well. But problem solving is going to serve the concert violinist well, too. I'm worried about everybody else who's not going to be a concert violinist or a professional soccer player or you name it. They're going to have to know how to solve problems with their significant other, with their children, with folks at work. So, you know, if I'm prioritizing, if I'm a parent, problem solving is actually pretty much number one on the list. Violin lessons, kind of far down the list. Violin lessons are a wonderful thing, nothing against violin lessons. Knowing how to solve problems and resolve conflict, even more important. So if we don't have time to do it, I think we're going to pay the price for it.
Makes sense. I appreciate you addressing that. That's a great way to talk about it. Yeah. With parents or teachers.
Now parents are really busy, but you know who also is really busy? Folks in schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's because the school day was designed around academics. School discipline is designed to be reactive. School discipline is designed to be focused on behavior, not the problems that are causing that behavior. And in many schools, school discipline is primarily punitive. Mm-hmm. Whether it was punitive or rewards, we're not solving any of the problems that are causing a student's challenging behavior. That's why we are spending mammoth amounts of time on challenging behavior. And that's also why it's the same 10, 20, 30 kids in every building who are accounting for 80 to 90% of the discipline referrals in that building.
Yep.
That's extraordinarily inefficient. So the time issue is an interesting one because that's what everybody's worried about. When people are implementing this model, they're not only saving time, they're probably saving money because of all that money that we spend placing kids into outside placements when we could have kept the kid in.
Right. So let me ask a practical question. How do you advise getting into the schools to even have these conversations if some of us wanted to do that?
Well, invite yourself. Often schools, you know, I've been in school meetings where the neuropsych report showed up. Sometimes it's 10 to 15 pages long.
Yep.
Sometimes it is dismissed. Sometimes it's incomprehensible.
Sure.
And often the comment is, you know, I'll take a look at this when the person who wrote it shows up to explain it to me.
Interesting. Okay.
Show up to explain it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Answer questions. Help them understand why rewarding and punishing is not going to address what's in that report.
Yeah.
I show up at schools all the time. They're often fascinated that I would do that, which is tragic
mm-hmm.
that the schools are surprised that the people who are working with the kid outside of school would show up. My attitude? Well, if he's having difficulty at school, I can't think of any place I'd rather be.
Makes sense.
Invite yourself.
Okay. Point taken. So I do want to touch on research. That's, I think a lot of people are probably interested in that. So what's the research looking like for these different settings?
Looking pretty good. To quote Larry David, pretty good.
Like it.
And the people who don't watch Larry David, of course, will have no idea what I just did, but
we'll put it in the show notes.
Larry David, right. plug. It's now an evidence-based model. There are now three large outpatient studies documenting its effectiveness
mm-hmm.
and documenting that its effectiveness is at least commensurate with what has become the standard of care, parent management training.
That's great.
There are at least two, I'm trying to remember, studies from inpatient units showing that this is a very effective, no more than two, like three or four or five now. I'm thinking of the two that I'm on, but there's more than that by people who've implemented it without me being a co-author.
Mm-hmm.
Significantly reduces or eliminates the use of restraint, seclusion. This is not published yet, but in juvenile detention, significantly reduces the use of hands-on procedures, including solitary confinement, significantly reduces staff and kid injuries, significantly reduces recidivism. In schools, dramatically reduces discipline referrals, suspension, detention. We have not implemented it yet in a school that paddles, but I'm chomping at the bit because we could get that down to zero, which is where it belongs. We have one study showing that it is effective in groups. Let me just scan my brain here. What else mm-hmm. we got? We've got a bunch of studies from the largest scale study of CPS that took place at the Virginia Tech Child Study Center. We've got lots of studies now on mediators and moderators of treatment response.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All of these can be found on the research page on the Lives in the Balance website.
Fantastic. And we will link to that in the show notes and all the other resources you mentioned. Yeah, yeah. That's great. I didn't realize that it is officially an evidence-based practice now.
It is.
That's fantastic. So it's there. What about that study you mentioned at the beginning, the Australian study comparing to parent management training?
We are just looking at the data now. I'm counting that as one of the three that I mentioned.
Cool, yeah.
Because I've now had a look at the data. There, we presented preliminary data at the World Congress in Melbourne, Australia 2 years ago. People can find those presentations on the research page on the Lives in the Balance website. But those papers, they'll be in published form probably in the next year to year and a half, and those will be posted on the same place. Mm-hmm. Pretty much showing the exact same thing, that the two models are commensurate with each other. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's what you need to do to be evidence-based. You need to show that your model is at least the equivalent of another well-established evidence-based model, mm-hmm. and CPS now is.
That's great. That's great. So I wanted to, I know, gosh, our time is flying, but I wanted to circle back and ask about the film. What's going on with the film?
The film has now been in three film festivals. It's called The Kids We Lose. And I, quite frankly, I'm not especially devoted to film festivals, but it's screening all over the country at this point. And it'll be in Australia in June and July, all over North America. I'm sure it'll make its way around the world. But and there's a website for it, thekidswelose.com, where people can find out if they want to screen it in their area, mm-hmm. how to go about doing that.
Okay.
As well as a video on the homepage of that website that's sort of a follow-up, because we really didn't want the film to be an advertisement for CPS. We really wanted it to be primarily an expose of what's still going on out there in way too many places. Mm-hmm. But there is a 16-minute video on the homepage of thekidswelose.com showing people what we hope they will do instead.
Gotcha.
And tons of video, of course, on the Lives in the Balance website. But basically, it's an expose. It's intended to heighten awareness of the human toll on everybody. Kids, parents, educators, staff members, that's taken by us continuing to use these heat of the moment, often punitive interventions that we've been talking about, that are extremely counterproductive, that don't solve the problems that are affecting the kid's life. It's a jungle out there, and many people aren't even aware of it. As I always tell people, unless you work with these kids, and some people who work with these kids aren't even aware of it, but mm-hmm. if you're the parent of one of these kids, you are aware of it. And the goal, of course, is not only to heighten awareness in general, but to advocate on behalf of change. And so one of the things Lives in the Balance is doing, with the documentary leading the way, is advocating for change. There are policies that need to be rewritten. There are practices that need to be virtually obsolete. There are settings in which the intervention is right now predominantly reactive, where intervention needs to be predominantly proactive. So there's some really important things that need to happen out there. And so long as my energy holds up, Lives in the Balance will be one of the organizations. There are others as well that are advocating for the changes that need to be made for some of our most vulnerable kids.
It's necessary work. You know, the fact that you've turned all of this into an advocacy arm, I think, is so admirable and needed.
That's, you know, it's a good example. You asked me earlier, how did I get to where I'm at?
Yeah.
How I got to where I'm at is by paying attention to what's needed and by trying to fill those gaps. Mm-hmm. So what I thought was needed early on was a different intervention that wasn't oriented toward rewarding and punishing. And what was needed was a heightened awareness of what factors contribute to challenging behavior in kids. And then what was needed was a book about that, and for parents. And then what was needed was a book for educators. Mm. None of these are things I knew. These are all things I stumbled upon along the way. Then what was needed was a nonprofit to disseminate all of this information for free, and a website to do that. And now what's become apparent, and was apparent, we're just sort of getting it organized, is advocacy to create those changes. Because what I've noticed over the last 30 years is that all those speaking engagements I've done, and the books that I've written, and the webinars I've done, they've made a dent. They're not enough. Now it's time to start making those changes happen.
That's incredible. It's really, really cool that you're taking the steps and you've crafted your life, you know, to in a way that allows you to do that. I think a lot of us have dreams or fantasies of that kind of thing. And to make it a reality is pretty amazing.
It feels doable to me that we can make these changes. It feels doable. And you know what? It's worth it. Whatever the obstacles are, we'll figure it out. But the good news is that here in Maine, there are plans for our legislators, some of them anyways, to watch the kids we lose. And if you watch the kids we lose, you're persuaded.
Yeah. I'm thinking about how can we get it screened here if it's not already coming. Who knows? I'm going to check that out.
Where are you again?
I am in Fort Collins, Colorado, so about an hour north of Denver.
It's screening in Denver.
Okay.
And I will – no, that was a different one. It's screening in Denver, I know, but all the screenings are on thekidsweLose.com as well.
Okay.
I want it screened everywhere so people know what's going on out there. But I'll tell you who I really want this to be in front of.
Mm-hmm.
The members of the Education and Labor Committee of the United States House of Representatives, which about 2 weeks ago had a hearing on restraint and seclusion. And I've had several people get back to me and say it was a complete waste of time. I hope it wasn't a complete waste of time, but this is a really important issue. We can't waste time on it. I want members of that committee to see this film, because if they see this film, they'll know that this is an urgent issue.
Sure. Are you, how close is that to being a reality? Getting in front of them? Yeah.
Well, if people sign up to be an advocator on the Lives in a Balance website, once again, mm-hmm. no cost, mm-hmm. then they will receive our newsletter, The Advocator. And on our first Advocator newsletter, we gave them names of and email addresses of every member of that committee in the U.S. House of Representatives mm-hmm. and their email addresses and urged them to see the film. And we're happy to make the film available to them if they want to see it.
Gotcha. That sounds good. Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, this podcast, I think, has a wide reach within a very small niche. But, you know, certainly there's some folks at APA that might be listening and might have some, I don't know, some power to take some steps in that direction.
This needs to be screened at ABCT. This needs to be screened. This will be screened at NAMI's National Convention in Seattle in a few months. It's screening at the CHAD National Conference in November in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
The more people who see this, the more people are aware of what's going on out there. And hopefully the more momentum there is for doing something about it.
That's right. It's fantastic. Like I said, it's good work. And I feel like
I get most passionate when I'm talking about this.
Sure. Well, it's needed, like I said, and it's been really cool to, I feel like we started kind of on the individual level and now we've gotten to this macro level and they're all important, but this stuff is maybe the most important, you know, to really affect change from the top down. Right.
I think so.
Well, that may be a good note to end on. If people have questions or thoughts or want to reach out or find some of this, what's the best way to get in touch and find you?
The two websites that we have mentioned both have contact forms. I would say the Lives in the Balance website's the better for the contact form. Mm-hmm. Go to the Lives in the Balance website, go to the contact form, and I'll get it somehow.
Okay. That sounds good. Well, I really appreciate the time. Like I said, both personally and professionally, this was a conversation that I've been wanting to have for a long time. So,
well, you put in the time too, and I really appreciate you doing it.
Of course. Well, best of luck in your ventures, and hopefully our paths will cross sometime again.
I'm sure they will.
Take care. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening to that interview with Dr. Ross Green. I was so thrilled to be able to get some of his time. He has a packed schedule with traveling and speaking and any number of other things going on, but very fortunate to have him sit down with me for a little while and talk about many things. I hope that you took away a lot of information about the collaborative and proactive solutions approach, and I think more than anything, just got a sense for Dr. Green's commitment and passion to this group of kids and other individuals who might benefit from a
non-rewards and consequences approach to interaction and behavior management. So go check out that documentary. I'm going to try to get it screened here, and we'll see where that goes. And check out his books. Everything that we talked about will be in the show notes, and probably some things we did not talk about.